Good evening and welcome to The Librarian on Authors on the Air. I am the librarian host, Tabitha Pope. This is a copyrighted and trademarked podcast owned solely by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC, on the web at authorsontheair.com. Tonight I have a special treat. I'm back to historicals, which is one of my favorite genres to read, Meredith Duran. She's the author of 10 previous novels, including The Duke of Shadows, which is the winner of the Gather.com First Chapters Romance Writing Competition, Wicked Becomes You, which was included in the Women's World list of Best Beach Reads for the summer of 2010, and the USA Today Bestseller and Rita Award winner, Fool Me Twice. She blames Anne Boleyn for sparking her lifelong obsession with British history and for convincing her that princely love is no prize if it doesn't come with a happily ever after. She enjoys collecting old etiquette manuals, guidebooks to 19th century London, and travelogues by intrepid Victorian women. You can visit her at MeredithDuran.com. She's on Twitter at Meredith Duran and Facebook at author Meredith Duran. And let me bring her live on the show. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad we could get you on. And you heard me, I almost slipped and said spanking.
I know, I laughed. I was like, that's actually pretty good.
That is the joys of being a romance reader right there. So Anne Boleyn, you really were a big thing. You liked the whole Henry VIII story, huh?
Oh, I was massively obsessed as a teenager. I think I took it a little too far at times. I went to a high school where you could choose any musical instrument you wanted to learn to play, so I decided I was going to learn the Renaissance lute. I braided my hair in styles I thought were Tudor.
Awesome.
Yeah, I got the nickname Medieval Girl from a couple of people in the class, and I wore it proudly. I thought it was a badge of honor. So yeah, I was definitely into the Tudors.
So what did you think of the Showtime adaption of the story?
So I had some problems with it. I feel like it was such a dramatic period. Factually, that I wasn't sure why they tried to make it more dramatic with some fictional inventions. I also didn't entirely understand the casting of is it Jonathan Rhys-Meyers who played Henry VIII?
Yeah.
And that, yeah. Have you seen Wolf Hall? Have you seen the PBS dramatization of Wolf Hall?
No.
That guy, he was the lead on I'm spacing on the television drama with the woman who was in My So-Called Life. Dates me right there.
She played
the CIA agent. Do you remember, you know the show I'm talking about?
Yes, the CIA agent.
Homeland. Yeah. So the guy who plays the returned soldier in Homeland, the redhead, he is the one that they cast as Henry VIII in the PBS drama. And I thought that was a lot closer. He's got that sort of bold, strapping presence because people often forget that Henry VIII, you know, we picture him as this, you know, morbidly obese man with a gout, you know, which is sort of how he was enshrined by Holbein. But he was a looker when he was young. He was tall. Wow. He was athletic. He was trim. And, neither our imaginations, you know, of the lumbering man with the cane, nor Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, I think, accurately capture his presence. So I prefer the Wolf Hall adaptation.
No, well, that's probably true. And you know, I get the picture of Henry VIII, just like you said, the obese man with the hat with the little feather hanging off the side, the whole bit. So, I agree. Interesting. And you really would have to be a student of that period to really kind of understand how long it was between it, you know, from the first wife to the end there when he died. It wasn't just 3 years or something. He didn't go through, you know, eight wives in 3 years. But they've made it seem that way. You know, they really did. Yeah.
There's actually a new PBS show that Lucy Worsley hosts. It was just a three-parter, I think. that looked at the six wives. And what I really liked about it, apart from the fact they did dramatic recreations in the actual sites, which was incredible, but I also really liked the fact that, yeah, it was visually stunning. But she focused in a good deal on Catherine of Aragon and really emphasized the fact that, you know, we often think of her now as this sort of pitiful figure, like shut up in a castle in a marshland somewhere, you know, while he romps around with Anne Boleyn. But they had quite a powerful romance that lasted, you know, I think almost two decades. So, it was actually quite a long period he spent with his first wife for the plot, as it were, and just descended into this kind of, I don't know, what would you call it, domestic abuser / murder mode? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I think, it makes you wonder, though, you know, with modern medical technology and things, if there wasn't so much more with him, you know, for him. I mean, power is one thing. Power makes people crazy, but doing stuff, being psychotic about it is just, there was, it's almost like there had to be something else with this guy.
Absolutely. I mean, he was the scholar king when he was young. When he was in his 20s, you know, his intellect was actually revered by some of the greatest scholars in Europe. So something went very wrong. Maybe that blow he took to his head when he was fencing, or jousting rather, when he was thinking he was still with Catherine of Aragon, maybe something, I don't know.
It went wrong.
It's a good theory.
A lobotomy,
What's that?
A lobotomy might have helped at that point, you know. Turn off that part of the brain.
Solved several problems, especially for Anne Boleyn.
So, what was the point that got you interested in the whole Anne Boleyn and this time period? Was there something in your childhood where you, were your parents historical buffs or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, they were huge readers. And so there was always an abundance of books around the house, but I think probably what led me to the Tudors was Shakespeare, because my parents took me to the Ashland Shakespeare Festival when I was in seventh grade, which is, you know, a ripe age for, for, you know, having your mind blown. And I think we saw Richard III. And, you know, I was working really hard to understand it, obviously, but there were these electrifying actors on stage. And I knew Shakespeare was a thing already. I didn't know why. And I was watching this play and I was like, this is amazing. You know, so I wanted to go home and read about Richard III, which sort of led me on this sprint through medieval English history. And then I think once I worked my way up to the Tudors, I stopped in shock because, you know, I think all English school children grow up knowing that rhyme, divorce, beheaded, died, divorce, beheaded, strive. But most American school children don't know that. At least I didn't.
Nope.
And I was like, what? There was a mass murderer who was an English king, but nobody called him that, you know? And so I just sort of became enwrapped. And I think Anne Boleyn, I mean, I think a lot of teenage girls are interested in Anne Boleyn because she seems like such a rebel. I mean, she was actually intellectually quite formidable. She had to have been to keep his attention for however many years before, you know, they actually got it on and then got married.
Mm-hmm.
I think it did start with Richard III and that performance at the Ashland Shakespeare Festival, rather twisted path, but I'm still a fan of Shakespeare too. So I guess, you know, I've stuck by my passions throughout the years.
That's so neat that you can kind of pinpoint that moment. And you know, the spark of passion kind of, whoo, it took off. And, were you always a writer, or was this something that came later?
Yeah. So I said when I was, I think I went through a phase where I said I would be a veterinarian and a writer, but I was always going to be a writer. So that was sort of my like base. And then I would like add on careers on top of that. If only one could be a veterinarian casually, you know, while writing full time.
Yeah, right.
Alas.
No, that doesn't work out. They barely make it. I mean, most vets I know barely make it anyway, because you know, there's not a ton of money in veterinarian. I mean, I guess they can make a really good living, but most of the ones I know just get by.
It's hard to get into veterinary school. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that they're not more richly rewarded, because I think it's harder to get into vet school than it is to get into med school.
Right.
Just because there are fewer
of
them, the competition is so fierce. Yeah, it does. Yeah. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned,
I'm
give
sure
them all the money.
Yeah, and I'm sure your student loans are just as high. So, yeah, absolutely. So did you write historical pieces young? Were you writing your own kind of, I don't know, what would you call that, your own stories or your own adaptations of what you thought?
Yeah, I think my first magnum opus was about a group of woodland creatures, like the king of the deer and things like that.
Oh, wow.
And then I got... Yeah, no, I had like an entire world developed around I can't remember what the king deer's name was, but I remember the queen was named Marina. And then I discovered the wonders of a donkey named Quirt, because my third grade teacher challenged us all to figure out what Quirt was, Q-W-E-R-T, but none of us were actually, you know, using keyboards at that point. Different generation, I guess. And so I decided it was a donkey, and I wrote, like, you know, I did the assignment and brought him, like, the, you know, whatever I'd written about Quirt. And he was like, oh, this is very creative, Meredith, and gave me an E. And then the next day I brought him more, and he was like, oh, you realize that assignment's over? And I was like, oh yeah, I just wanted you to see what happened. And then I kept doing that, and I think finally he was like, okay, the tale of Quirt has ended. You should write about something else.
How
so the
funny,
bug was
Quirt.
Always in me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That one's
strange
not
places.
Published,
you get...
I have to say.
No, but that's neat. Do you still have it though? Do you have it around?
Somewhere, yeah, in one of my very large stacks of writing, probably buried between Star Trek: The Next Generation pieces of fan fiction, because I was a mad fan of The Next Generation when I was in like fifth and sixth grade. And that sort of replaced the woodland creature thing. And, you know, it was like 3 years of writing about Captain Picard.
So when did you, start reading historical romances at an early age as well?
So I discovered them. I remember the day I discovered historical romance. So I was 13. And back at that time, there actually weren't, it just sounds crazy now, right? But at least I couldn't find many historical novels that featured women as sort of main characters. And I also, you know, at 13, I wanted to read, I didn't like what I was finding in a lot of historical fiction, because it was all very political and like wars and battles and, like, you know, men being men on the battlefield and off in the bar, you know. So But I was reading them because I was already really into English history. And I found a discarded copy, still have no idea whose it was, of Judith McNaught's, I think it was Almost Heaven, I think is the name, Almost Heaven. It's Ian and Elizabeth, whatever their story was called. I still remember their names better than I do the title. And at that time, maybe this was the signal for historical romance, but I didn't know it. It was just sort of a pastel cover with flowers. So there was like no cue. There wasn't a step back showing them in like a lurid embrace. I had no idea what I was picking up, but I started reading it and I was like, oh, cool. It's set in England in the 19th century. And there's a lady in the center of the story. This is awesome. And then I kept reading and I was like, oh, this is so neat. It's not about, like, you know, grand politics and kings. It's about what it was like to live every day in this different time period, which was like my thing, really. I really wanted to, like, I'd close my eyes like at night and like imagine what it would be like to live in a different time. It just was really fascinating. And this book nailed it in a way that no other historical fiction had. And then I hit the first sex scene and I was like, what is happening? No clue. I was like bright red, like slammed the book shut, like looked around, was like, is this book supposed to be legal? Like, I didn't even know, you know, because I didn't know about that. I never encountered a romance novel, which sounds crazy, but the closest I'd come was like, I read A Kiss in Sweet Valley High books once, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I kept reading and I was like, you know, I finished the book and I was like, this was amazing. And I went to the bookstore, probably a B. Dalton, remember those days, you know, R.I.P. the Dalton.
Yes, yes.
And walked in and there was like this sort of like awkward, gangly adolescent guy working behind the counter. And I was like, does this person, do you have any more books by this person? And Judith Vignott. And he looked at it and he sneered and he was like, that's romance. And I was like, oh, I'm reading a romance novel and I'm liking it. And I was just like, okay, so be it. Where's the romance section? So that is how I discovered romance. It was historical romance that got me started reading. And I do read contemporaries. I love paranormals, but historicals are what brought me into the genre and they are where my heart resides. So that has not changed either.
That's awesome. That's a great story. I love it. It's so funny how many people talk about that gateway read right around 12 or 13, really kind of just, you know, they probably, then they're always like, I probably shouldn't have been reading it, but I was, and I loved it, you know.
But I mean, you know, I always question that because what a wonderful paradigm. I mean, I know that there are some very problematic things in 90s romances, but at the same, and I'm sure in contemporary romances, but at the same time, that it offers a paradigm to a young girl at a very influential age that, like, you should be able to expect great things of a relationship.
Right.
That there is someone out there, I mean, that is going to treat you with respect if you, you know, and is going to consider your feelings just as important, if not more important, than their own. And there are also really positive messages about sex in the books, you know, that, like, this isn't something that you just endure. Like, so,
right.
You know, yes, on the one hand, it is a real shock as a 13-year-old to come across those scenes. But on the other hand, I don't think it scarred me, quite the opposite. I think I had very high standards when I was on the dating market, and they paid off because I have a wonderful husband.
There you go. Yay, Judith McNaught.
Thank you, Judith.
You did it for her. So at what point in, you know, as you came into adulthood and moved on, did you decide that you were going to write a book, not just write for, you know, your own being, or that you were going to write a story that you wanted to go out into the world?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been writing novel-length stories for a while. So, I mean, I wrote my first, I think you'd call it novel-length, it's about 400 pages when I was in ninth grade. The stories I was writing got longer and longer and longer. They weren't all romances. The first, I think, novel-length story I wrote was a fantasy novel, which I still kind of love. but because I was reading romance, you know, so much, you know, obviously a lot of the ones I was writing were romances. And I had one that when I was, you know, just out of college, was like, I feel like this is pretty good and, like, I should try to sell this, and couldn't find an agent for it and was like, okay, guess not. And so I applied to grad school, which is something, you know, I also wanted to do, like, was also on my radar that I was going to go and get a PhD in cultural anthropology. So I started the program, and then my sister actually texted me, or I think this was actually before text. Wow, text hasn't been around that long, actually. I think she emailed me and was like, hey, there's this contest that Simon & Schuster is throwing with Gather.com, and to find a romance novel, and to enter, all you have to do is have a completed romance novel. Don't you have one that you were trying to get an agent for? And I was like, yeah, it's somewhere around here. But I was in the middle of, like, qualifying exams, or I was coming up on qualifying exams. I was a little overwhelmed. And she was just like, well, just submit it. And I was like, this is one of those contests, though, where you have to, like, rally for votes and, like, the people that talk votes go through. She was like, just submit it and forget about it. And I thought, well, what's the harm? So I literally did drag the manuscript out from the bed. There was nothing under the bed. There was nothing proverbial about it. It was really under the bed. So I pulled it out from under the bed. Yeah, and, you know, submitted the entry and forgot about it because I was in the middle of a pretty rigorous set of exams at that time. And I noticed that I got through the, like, semifinal round or quarterfinal or whatever, and I was like, that's cool. You know, I wasn't one of the ones who got voted through on the popular vote, but I was an editor's pick, I guess. And then, you know, I got through, like, the next round, so suddenly there were only five of us, and I was like, what? Like, what's happening here? But was still pretty distracted because this qualifying exam was pretty intense. And then, you know, I knew when they were going to announce the winner. And I was trying not to think about it because really, since I could speak, my parents can testify to this, since I could speak, I was saying I was going to be a writer. And going into this PhD program was really important to me. Like I am very passionate about anthropology, but the writing has been with me since I can remember, as far back as I can remember. Mm-hmm. Like, I was dictating stories to my mother before I could write, you know, that sort of thing. Bless her heart.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mom. So, you know, I couldn't think about it too much because it felt like it was a little too overwhelming. And I was just like, there's no way I'm going to win anyway, you know. And then I got home the day before the winner was going to be publicly announced. And there was a 212 call on my phone. I have friends in New York, but I was like, nobody would be calling in the middle of the day. And then, you know, I sat there basically in dead silence, doing nothing, just sat there like stock still. Until the number called back, and it was the editor I still have, Lauren McKenna, being like, you won. Congratulations, your book's going to be published. And my first thought was, oh my God, how long do I have to revise? Because I haven't looked at this book in a while, and I'm sure it needs work. So she did, thankfully, give me some time to revise, which was much needed.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, and we've been working together ever since, is how it really happened.
That is really awesome. That's a great story. You took the chance, but you didn't like worry about it too much. So that's really great.
I'm sure part of me was worrying about it, you know, but like I had something else to worry about too, which really helped. Like having another object for all of my anxiety, these exams was actually really helpful in retrospect.
Probably. I can understand. Grad school is very stressful. It's stressful. It's great. And I'd go back in a heartbeat if somebody else would pay for it. But
that's always
not getting a sugar daddy, already married. So, you know. So cultural anthropology, that's really neat. How much of that do you use? Do you draw from any of that when you write?
I'm sure I do. Certainly the research skills I formulated in the anthropology program do help me a great deal when I'm doing research for the books. And also just the rigor of the education I received, I would hope, is reflected somewhat in the way I think about the issues in the books. It's a fascinating field, and that it does connect in sort of many subtle ways to the creative writing. The closest I ever came to really having a direct connection was when I wrote my second book, Bound by Your Touch, which was the heroine in that is the daughter of an archaeologist and is sort of very interested in sort of the rudimentary beginnings of what would become anthropology. So, not surprisingly, that's the next book I wrote after my debut, which, you know, while I was in the thick of all of that, sort of like the theoretical education I was getting. I would hope it informs my thought in every way, but I don't think that it's too obvious on the page in my books.
So tell me a little bit about your research process. Now, do you plan it all out in the beginning and do your research, or do you find yourself just writing and researching as you go?
So I love research. Research is actually a bit of a vice with me, but it becomes a procrastinatory technique.
Right.
So I have to be a little bit self-disciplined about it. I was reading the other day, I can't remember who the author was, who was saying that what she had done, I feel like it might have actually been the woman who wrote Seabiscuit. I'm spacing on her name. She's very, like, Seabiscuit. And, she said that the way she did research on the time period when she was writing that book, and don't quote me because perhaps it wasn't her, but I feel like it was, she would bring out a huge stack of newspapers, one for every day of the year in which she was writing, and read through them. And I was like, that is a fantastic idea. I approach that. I spend a lot of time. The archive.org and Google Books are treasure troves for people writing historical fiction that, you know, is set in the 19th century or later, because so much primary material is on there now available, you know, while you're sitting at your laptop. It's astonishing. when I was still.
Isn't that wild?
It's amazing, and it's so much fun. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And this most recent book, my book that came out on Tuesday, is that the hero actually gives a speech in the House of Commons. And I had never written, I don't think I'd ever written a scene set in the House of Commons in any of my books beforehand. And I was pretty intimidated by this scene. One, I not only had to come up with a powerful speech, but two, the House of Commons, you know, there's just something for some reason I had a bit of a block. And so, of course, I spent 3 or 4 days reading everything I could find from this particular time period, which was very tricky because they remodeled the House of Commons, of course,
mm-hmm.
both before and after
mm-hmm.
my book takes place. So I had to be clear that I was reading about the actual setup that he would have walked into in that scene. And, you know, what's amazing about research is as you're reading these words that were written so long ago, and oftentimes the Victorians were incredibly vivid and interesting writers, so it's not a hardship. Ideas come
mm-hmm.
to you. It research is part of plotting for me because it generates the story in my mind. So I remind myself of that when I feel guilty about how much time I'm spending in my research, 99% of which never makes it into the book. Which, you know, that too I've gotten better at because I think I used to top load and my second book was a bit top loaded, but I loved it. You know, and some readers
yeah.
like it. Some readers were like, you know, cut back on that a little, Duran. I was like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, research is it's an addictive thing because the more you more time you spend, the more time you want to spend because you keep finding
mm-hmm.
things that are even more intriguing. And I have that problem with genealogy.
I know a lot of people who are addicted to that. I mean,
Absolutely, because you find a little story, you find a newspaper clipping, you find a family Bible, and it opens up more questions.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to go figure out that. And I mean, it's.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible, and I really had to like cut myself off. Like I needed a 12-step program for it because I was addicted. I would be up till 3 o'clock in the morning looking at every possible place on the webs to, you know, find information,
mm-hmm.
and then I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about it, and I'd write notes down what to look for, and then find my way to the library to get, you know, so I could go dig. So, yeah, it was horrible.
Well, see, you just have to write historicals because then you can call this, you know, preparatory work.
right, yes. But, you know, it's just one of those, I feel time-pressed for some reason to get it done,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know why these people have been dead for hundreds of years and they don't care. But, you know, it feels like urgent. I get this urgent, like, I need to find out. I got to know what happened to that person. Why did they die in that state? And are their families here? And, you know, why were they there? And, yeah, I start making those stories and connections, and I understand. It's very addictive. That's why I told you beforehand that I don't think I could write historical because I think I would never get anything done, ever, first of all. Because I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. That, you know, the side character that has nothing to do with the actual story that I'm talking about. But, oh, I just found something interesting while I was researching that. And I'm going to have to go find everything I can on that person now and, you know, go off on a tangent and never get back to it. So,
oh, it's the best
very
kind
bad.
Of dangerous, though. The best
I know,
kind.
It's awesome. That's what I'm going to do when I retire. I'm just going to, I got a list of interesting things I want to find out about that I'm going to just spend all my time just reading about them. So anyway, real life comes in between all of that. So you got the kids and the bills and all of that stuff. So, so like we were talking about before, you know, I write contemporary. I have a short story that's published, but that's where my stories come from because that's what I've been, you know, into for so long. It's everything that goes on around me that I draw from, but I can see where, you know, someone like you who is interested in things and studying time periods can, yeah, you can, when you start to dig into that research, it does create these stories. What if this person did this? And what if they did
mm-hmm.
that? And then a whole story comes from that. This is wonderful thing. that I think only people who are passionate about history can really get into those things. So, like that.
Well, then there are those wonderful, eerie pieces of serendipity where you think you've invented something, and when you just happen to Google it, you realize it was actually a thing. Like there was a type of corset that I really wanted to use in Wicked Becomes You. And I was just like, this is so clear in my mind, and yet I do not want to commit a gross historical anachronism. So was there anything like this? And indeed there was, and it was actually uncannily similar in the way it was named to what I had used in the scene. And moments like those are like so neat. It's just like there's some sort of larger intelligence lurking out there that's like, okay, you can have this. And like flicks that piece of data into your brain. Yeah.
That's neat. And, you know, who knows? I mean, who knows? It may have, yeah, absolutely. I would think that if you haven't read that particular description before and you were thinking about it, that something had to have put that there. That's trippy. That's my word, trippy. So tell us, we're about halfway through the show, and if anybody wants to call in to talk to Meredith, the phone number is 347-633-9609. Feel free to call in. So tell me a little bit about winning the Rita, because that had to be really interesting and fun for you.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. It was like one of those moments that was so extraordinary that I think I kind of went into shock. I was like, okay, wait, did they actually just say my name? And you know, I really legitimately was not expecting to win. I was up against some really wonderful, really well-loved romance writers. And my editor was like, get up. I was like, oh, okay, so that actually happened. And then I'm like, okay, I have to get onto the stage without falling. And then realized I was like leaving her behind. She was like, wait for me. The whole thing was like a thank goodness, like rather unnoticeable comedy of errors. But yeah, it was surreal and it was amazing. I consider it the highest honor that I could have hoped for, you know, as a writer. And it was extraordinary. Having my husband there was pretty awesome because he like was almost more excited than I was. He insisted on like walking around Times Square posing with the Rita statue in various iconic spots.
It's the Oscars of romance writers. You know, it's like the ultimate award you can get as a romance writer, and it really is. It is worth all the great selfies with your Rita. It is so worth it.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. And I just, you guys that write and put this stuff out for all of us to enjoy and, you know, create the magic in our own minds. Historical just blows my mind. I think I said this already that, I really respect historical authors, all historical authors, because of you have to get it right. You know, you don't want to make the error of your character speaks the wrong way for the time period or wears inappropriate clothing or whatever, you know, type of thing. And it's amazing to me. This is just a funny aside. I am really into Outlander, I should say. And my husband got into it when he won't, of course, read the books, they're too big, but he has enjoyed the show and the horrible scenes with Jamie at the end of the first season. Yeah. With Blackjack Randall, and he's naked. Blackjack Randall stands up, and my husband immediately mentions, he's like, "How about that?" And I was like, "What? He's filthy. He's disgusting." You know, and he's like, "No, but you know, they had to search for a man that was not circumcised," and I was like, "How do you think? What?" You know, but he was right. You know, I mean, time period wise, back then they. they didn't do those sort of things. And I was just like, wow, I can't believe you caught that.
Small historical details.
Yes, exactly. But that you know, for somebody who was thinking along that line, that could have blown it right there for them. You know, they would have noticed. But it is the small historical details, and that's like, again, why I have so much respect for historical writers for getting it right. And I've read some historicals that don't, and it's a shame. Because some people are rude and mean about it, and that's okay. I mean, nobody's going to get everything right all the time. But, you know, I've read somewhere, and they were probably self-published, that they didn't really care to get it right. You know, they just kind of wrote their thing. And it kind of takes away from it. And, of course, being a librarian, I'm like fact-checking everything. I'm going to Google this right now, you know. But yeah, no, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that you guys do for sure. So tell me, do you enjoy the Victorian time period, Regency time period?
So I've never written a Regency. You would not know it by looking at the fashions on the covers of some of my books, but I have skipped over the Regency quite neatly. The earliest I've set a story was in 1715, the first Jacobite rebellion, the one that Diana did not write about. And the latest would be 1890, The Wicked Becomes You, which takes place partly in Paris in 1890, which was fun. But, you know, I do tend to prefer the mid to later Victorian period for several reasons. 1715 was a fascinating time to write about, but it was impossible in that book not to avoid focusing heavily on sort of the politics and the religious politics specifically of the period, because it was so fraught back then. In the late 19th century, what I really like about that, most of the rules for the Reckless series is set in the 1880s. In fact, most of my books are. I think it's a really interesting time. So at that point in London, if you had a lot of money, you were starting to get your house electrified, for instance. But most other people were on gaslight. And then you go out to the rural areas, and there are people that might still be burning candles. I mean, so there's this vast spectrum. But the changes that are happening so rapidly. So at the latest of my novels, there might be a telephone in the house. But, you know, a lot of that happened within a 10-20 year span. And you also see this sudden massive expansion of roles for women. So in the 1880s, women were working as clerks at the post office for the first time, for instance, and there were female typists. There's that great George Gissing novel that was published in the 1880s called Odd Women, which is all about the plight of these women who were actually this newfangled kind of creature who were working and living together alone without, you know, male relatives around them in the capital, and like their sort of difficulties in navigating or really creating this entirely new role for women. But it all happened really so quickly that I feel like there are echoes between that period and the time that I've grown up in which, you know, when I was a kid, email was something that you really didn't know about unless you were, you know, a coder, you know, in Silicon Valley or like, you know, one of the really early adoptees of Usenet and things like that. And then by the time I was in high school, like, you know, email was a thing. So that, the sort of the transformation of the world through the internet and then more recently social media, I feel like in some ways we're dealing with some of like the shocks from this entirely new way of relating and thinking about things that the Victorians were dealing with, first with the telegraph and then with the telephone and this like upheaval and gender roles and all that stuff. So I find it a really interesting period that offers a lot of freedom to write a lot of different kinds of conflicts that are really like very location specific, like the kinds of liberties enjoyed by the daughter of an upper crust, wealthy upper crust person in London would be light years away from the sort of life prospects of a middle class banker's daughter in, you know, northern England, and then once again light years away from, say, a farmer's daughter in Herefordshire. So that's just, it offers a lot of scope for a lot of different kinds of stories, and I find that really appealing because I do write a lot of ballroom settings, but I get very bored when I am stuck in carriages and ballrooms, because a lot of the stuff I read from that period, you know, diaries and travelogues by these women who seem like they could have stepped out of historical romance, they themselves are quite insistent on not getting stuck in the carriages and ballrooms, you know, and they're really
right.
pushing the boundaries. So I like to follow that kind of woman around and see what kind of trouble she can get into.
That sounds exciting. Tell us a little bit about your book that released just this week, and just a little, they call it a blurb, a little synopsis of the story.
Right. You know, I haven't tried a blurb orally yet, so let me give it a try. So first I should say
okay.
this is my 11th book with pocketbooks, and I nobly restrained myself until my 11th book to finally write the amnesia book, which I have been dying to write since I read, was it Mary Balog's, was it One Perfect Rose, I believe, in which Stephen has amnesia, and I was like, this is the best idea for a book ever. One day I'll write one of these books, so I finally have. But it took a while to figure out what story deserved it, right? When you have something you've been waiting to write forever,
right.
you have to really wait until it feels correct. So I found it. I found it in Jane Mason, who is the very wealthy heiress under the grip of her guardian uncle, who has plans for her money. He's very sad that Jane comes attached to it, and marrying her to his son, her cousin, would be the best way to separate her from it, right? But she's not so keen on that. You know, she's not keen on having been buried in the countryside by her uncle for 6 years. So her uncle's into politics, and he's got a very, very nasty friend, Crispin Burke, who is a totally jaded and corrupt politician himself. And she and Crispin strike a bargain. He'll help her get out of this marriage to her cousin if she agrees to, you know, give him info on the sly about what her uncle, who's also in politics, is up to. But this goes awry when Crispin's own sort of noxious activities come back to bite him. And he basically is attacked, and everyone thinks he's on his deathbed. And Jane, having listened to him a little too closely, knows how to get a marriage certificate forged that says she and Crispin are married. And she does this because she knows Crispin's about to knock off, and then she'll be widowed and free. Of course, the catch is Crispin doesn't die. Crispin wakes up. He wakes up, however, without any memories of his adult life. So he's a very different person. And Jane doesn't want to be arrested for forgery and fraud, so she has to go with this role because for all he knows, they are married. He remembers nothing. So he's looking on her as a wife and as a potential helpmeet as he struggles to sort of recover his bearings and continue with his job as an MP in Parliament. And Jane herself has to walk a very fine line because she doesn't want him to know that she is lying, that they aren't actually wed. But she also does not like him, what she remembers of him. But here's the catch.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very different guy without his memories of the last 5 years. In fact, he's a guy that maybe she could fall in love with. So that's the book.
I like it. And that's really exciting. I'm glad you found a place for your amnesia. That's awesome.
Yes, and it was fun to write. You know, it was one of those books, some books, including books that people seem to have liked very much, fought me tooth and nail. But this book was one of the rare ones that, like, you know, I struggled a little for the first month or two to wrap my mind around it. And the third month it went click, and then everything just went bang, bang, bang into place. It was amazing. It was like skating downhill, which, you know, happens very rarely. May it happen again soon, knock on wood.
Well, that's good. No, good. Let it happen again. That's good. When a story comes to you that easily, you know it's meant to be. So that's a wonderful thing. So is this is a standalone, or is it part of a bigger series?
It is technically part of the Rules for the Reckless series for reasons that are not very clear right now, but will be made clear in the next book. Book, which is set up at the end of this book, anyone who's reading has been like, wait, is this next book going to be about ... Because I've gotten more emails about the man at the end of that ... than I have about any other character I've ever written. His name is Lockwood. He first appeared in my very first novel, The Duke of Shadows. And for the last, wow, it's been 9 years now, people have been emailing saying, where is Lockwood's book? Because it was blatantly set up in The Duke of Shadows, and then I didn't write it. And I didn't write it because the longer I waited to write it, the more intimidated I felt by it. I was like, oh, no, how can I do this story justice? But
yeah.
the way became clear to me in writing this book. So Lockwood's will be the next book. And I can finally reply to all of those emails and say, it's the next one, which I'm really looking forward to doing because for 9 years I've been like, so sorry, not yet. Yeah.
Well, then it's obviously a character that you developed well enough for people to really be intrigued enough to send you an email and say, hey, so that's good. And you shouldn't be intimidated by him because he's obviously going to come talk to you and let you write his story really well.
He's going to have some dark things to say. He was hit on his head in Shanghai on his wedding day and has been missing for 4 years. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's got quite a tale to tell.
Yeah, I'd say. So what else do you have planned for 2017 and into the future?
Yeah, so Lockwood's book will probably be in 2018, I believe. Don't quote me on that. It could be at the end of 2017, but I'm guessing 2018. And the next thing I have out this year is actually a little unusual. Five of us who are romance writers were asked to submit short stories / novellas to an anthology that's modeled after an anthology that was actually published in the 19th century. And the gimmick, as it were, about this anthology is first each writer is writing out of their normal comfort zone. So my novella is not historical romance. It's romantic, but it's not historical. I won't say any more than that, though, because the gimmick for the anthology is that none of us are attaching our names to the individual stories. Our names will be on the cover, but for the first 3 months, we're not going to say who wrote which story. We're going to see if people can guess. And then after those 3 months are up, we will reveal which story we actually wrote ourselves. So that was fun. I mean, I can't say anything about what I wrote because I don't want to give any clues.
Nope.
But I had a good time with it. Let me tell you, it felt very, very strange, and then like suddenly super liberating to not be writing in 19th century England. So we'll see. We'll see what people think, though.
Do you ever plan to step outside the historical again?
Historical. Well, you know, I never say never because I read so many different kinds of fiction that I could easily see myself writing different kinds of fiction just because as a reader, I read really omnivorously. But historical, as I've told you, you know, has my heart. So I'm not sure I would ever leave it behind. I might try new things, but I think I'm here to stay with the historical business.
Well, if you get it right and your fans love it, then that's all that you can ask for. So it's really good. And you want to read us, so obviously you're doing something right. So keep it going.
Yes, the Golden Lady. She is there on my desk right now giving me courage.
Ah, that's awesome. So let's talk about your website. Do you have a newsletter, monthly newsletter?
I do have a newsletter. I actually am sending out a new newsletter this weekend. So if you haven't signed up, go to meredithduran.com and do so to hear from me or to hear from me and then remove yourself from the newsletter. I don't know. That's a political act. Maybe you are a fan of contemporaries. You want me to know that.
Okay. I'm sure you've got that more than once. there's all kinds out there, aren't there? What about I know you're on Twitter and you also have an author page on Facebook. Where's the best place to follow you online as far as like what's going on?
I would say Facebook because increasingly I found the 140 character limit on Twitter just irksome. So I like Facebook because
so
there's
limiting.
All these. Yeah, there's all these cool articles I find mostly about, you know, historical stuff that I like to post and then discuss with readers about. So I tend to spend most time on Facebook. The other thing about Twitter, the other reason I'm resisting Twitter right now is because I'm writing Lockwood's book. And Twitter, unlike Facebook, seems to like eat into my brain and like colonize my attention span. So if I've spent an hour on Twitter, then I'm like wandering around for an hour, flapping my hands and being like, what, focus. Whereas Facebook, for whatever reason, doesn't do that to me. So you can visit me on Facebook. If you want to email me, there's actually an email button on Facebook. You can just email me directly from there. Otherwise, you can email MeredithDuran@gmail.com. That works too.
Wonderful. And you're right in the middle of a blog tour as well this week.
I am. This is like my first, I think, bona fide blog tour. It feels that way. Maybe I've done a smaller one before, but this was pretty intense.
They're fun. They're a lot of fun. It just really spreads the word, and it's amazing how much the bloggers are still, you know, there was talk a couple of years ago about, you know, blogs aren't as influential as they were, and I still say they reach a lot of people out there. So, you know,
I mean,
that's
where I get, yeah, that's where I get my recommendations as a reader.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So, yeah, I mean, some of them are like good friends to me now, even though I don't know them, because I feel that way because of their recommendations. So, yeah, I agree with you. Well, good for that.
And those friendships, I think those friendships are real. That's the extraordinary thing. Like when you really come to know someone through their blog and like go back and forth with them, you meet them at a conference. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful how seamlessly it translates into real life, you know? So I hope that community never goes away. I don't think any other form of social media can replace it.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Like you said, they're too limiting. They really are, mm-hmm. and they keep changing the way they do everything too often. So a blog, it's kind of, as far as for that kind of communication, I think it's just a wonderful medium for it.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I'm glad we got you in during your blog tour. And again, this we do have a caller. See if
Hello.
Hi, you're live on The Librarian.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth, and I was wondering, like, which of your heroes is your favorite? Because I've read all your books, and I really love Julian.
Oh,
I'm just
going to
tell you,
Julian. Julian's the favorite.
We have about 5 minutes, so let's start.
Okay.
Just so you know. I'm just telling you so we don't get cut off.
Okay, all right, yeah. I think my favorite still is Sandburn, to be honest, from Bound by Your Touch. He ties with Nick from Luck Be a Lady, and what they both have in common is they both have a very cheeky sense of humor, which never turns malicious. I think that's a crucial, crucial quality to why I love their sense of humor so much. And they're both a bit roguish.
Oh, I like Sandburn, too.
Yeah, Julian's awesome, though. Julian, I think, remains my true alpha. He's a very upright, honorable guy who has a lot on his shoulders. So, yeah.
thank you so much. I love
awesome.
Your books.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth. Okay, and we have one more.
Okay.
Hi, you're live on The Librarian.
Hi, this is Karen.
Hi, Karen. I think I know this Karen. Do I know this Karen?
Yes, you do.
All right. Hi.
I was wondering if in Lockwood's books there are going to be any pets.
You mean like maybe a puppy?
Yes.
Yes. Well, so Karen is Karen and I know each other from online, and Karen has probably been watching me besiege my Facebook page with many photos of my new puppy, Bo. It is very tempting. It will be very tempting to incorporate a mischievous puppy. I don't know. I actually hadn't thought about that, but you have the wheels spinning now, Karen. Thank you for the idea.
That's what I'm here for.
See, readers are awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can be a reader and a muse. It's awesome.
Yeah, and I was planning on reading right now, but I've been listening to podcasts instead, so I'll have to read faster when I get off the song.
I'm so sorry for disrupting your reading, Karen.
That's okay. I have dogs on my lap anyway.
Oh, that's the best way to be.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to hang up now.
Thanks for
bye,
calling
Karen.
In.
Okay. Sure. Bye.
Well, that was good. Two callers.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, that's good. Well, and it's nice to put, when you get to put a voice with a name that someone you've communicated with online for so long,
yeah.
Like you were talking about, those friendships are real. They're real. They're
absolutely
interesting.
Absolutely, they are.
But anyway, so again, thank you so much for being on, and I'm glad we got you on right in the middle of your blog tour, and I hope that everybody that's listening goes and checks the Facebook page so you can see all the other wonderful things that the bloggers are doing for Meredith this week.
Yes, all in honor of a lady's code of misconduct, which you can find at a bookstore near you.
There you go. Yeah, all major retail outlets. All right.
Thank you
well,
so much for
have
having
a great,
me. It's been wonderful.
Oh, I'm glad you. We had a great talk. I enjoyed it. I really did. And I wish you much luck, and I look forward to the rest of it. I'm going to have to go back and start with the Duke of Shadows just so I can know who Lockwood is. So there you go.
It's actually very timely. Very timely to start with that one. Yeah.
Okay. Good deal. Will do. All right. You have a great evening and stay warm up there.
Thanks, Tabitha.
All right. And everybody, thanks for listening in tonight. I will be back next Thursday at my usual time, 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on The Librarian. This broadcast has been recorded, and it will be available as a podcast from the Authors on the Air website, from SoundCloud and iTunes. Authors on the Air Global Radio Network can be found online at www.authorsontheair.com. And you can find us just about anywhere else in the social media universe that you can think of. And I'd like to also invite you to check out our list of shows on our website. We have, I think, about 15 shows, new ones being added almost, seems like almost every week. And they're all different genres. So if you're a big reader and you read other genres, thrillers, crime, all kinds of things, young adult, we've got it all. So check out our website and you can find some other great podcasts to listen to as well. Have a great evening and sweet dreams from the librarian.